Yata as Jale
in the water,
Chandramasa
of the moon,
Kampadhi
quivering,
etc. Tatkrita, done by the water,
Gunaha,
quality,
Drishyate,
it is so seen,
Asanapi,
without existence,
Drastu,
of the seer,
Atmana,
of the self,
and
Atmana,
of
other than the self.
Gunaha,
quality. Translation. As the moon reflected on water appears to the seer to tremble due to being associated with the quality of the water, so the self associated with matter appears to be qualified as matter. Let's do that responsibly. As the moon reflected on water appears to the seer to tremble due to being associated with the quality of water,
so the self associated with matter
appears to be qualified as matter. Report by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The Supreme Soul, the Personality of Godhead, is compared to the moon in the sky, and the living entities are compared to the reflection of the moon on water. The moon in the sky is fixed and does not appear to quiver like the moon on the water. Actually, like the original moon in the sky, the moon reflected on the water should also not quiver, but because of being associated with water, the reflection appears to be quivering, although in actual fact the moon is fixed. The water moves, but the moon does not move. Similarly, the living entities appear to be tainted by material qualities like illusion, lamentation, and miseries, although in the pure soul, such qualities are completely absent. The word pratiyate, which means apparently and not actually, like the experience of having one's head cut off in a dream, as mentioned in the previous verse, is significant here. The reflection of the moon on the water is the separated rays of the moon and not the actual moon. The separated parts and parcels of the Lord entangled in the water of material existence have the quivering quality, whereas the Lord is like the actual moon in the sky, which is not at all in touch with water. The light of the sun and moon reflected on matter makes the matter bright and praiseworthy. The living symptoms are compared to the light of the sun and the moon, illuminating material manifestations like trees and mountains. The reflection of the sun or moon is accepted as the real sun or moon by less intelligent men, and the pure monistic philosophy develops from these ideas. In fact, the light of the sun and the moon are actually different from the sun and the moon themselves, although they are always connected. The light of the moon spread throughout the sky appears to be impersonal. But the moon planet, as it is personal, and the living entities on the moon planet are also personal. In the rays of the moon, different material entities appear to be comparatively more or less important. The light of the moon on the Taj Mahal appears to be more beautiful than the same light in the wilderness. Although the light of the moon is the same everywhere due to being differently appreciated, it appears different. Similarly, the light of the Lord is equally distributed everywhere, but due to being differently received, it appears to be different. One should not therefore accept the reflection of the moon on the water as actual and misunderstand the whole situation through monistic philosophy. The quivering quality of the moon is also variable. When the water is standing still, there is no quivering. A more settled conditioned soul quivers less. But due to material connection, the quivering quality is more or less present everywhere. So I'll read the verse again. Yatha jale chandramasa akam padisthat krito ganaha drishyate sannapi drastu atmano natmano ganaha. As the moon reflected on water appears to the seer to tremble, due to being associated with the quality of the water, so the self associated with matter appears to be qualified as matter. So this verse of the Bhagavatam, as in previous verses, is an answer to questions that Vidura is asking in this chapter. This text number 11, is an answer to the third question that Vidura asks, which was in text number 6. So I'll just read that question. So Vidura asks that the Lord, as the super soul, is situated in every living being's heart. So God is within the heart of every living entity. Why then do the living entity's activities result in misfortune and misery? Right, so that's the question, and here is the answer in this verse, text number 11. So, you know, it's a very good question. This is the beauty of this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. It's described that whatever you'll find in any of the religious scriptures of the world, you will find in practically the Bhagavad Gita, what to speak of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a postgraduate study. But there's more, so much more. Practically, if you spent your entire life asking the most difficult philosophical questions and couldn't come to an end to those questions, all of those questions are answered in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. But if the questions are there and the answers are there, but you won't find these questions even in other scriptures, what to speak of the answer. You won't even find this question in other scriptures, what to speak of the answer. This is the, you know, the glory of the Bhagavatam. It is in a very, very exalted philosophy. Such a nice question. Because we hear, that, you know, there is a common misunderstanding, of course, that one may think that we are one with God. And because, you know, it may seem incomprehensible how on earth someone can think they're God, but it's connected to the fact that everyone ultimately would love to be God, you know. So much so that, you know, when you really want something, you can believe anything, you know. So somewhere deep down, you know, there's that desire, ultimately, which brought us here to the material world, that we want, you know, that envy. We want to be the master. We don't want to be the servant. We want to be God. So it doesn't take much to convince us, you know, that, oh, yes, you can be, you know, you can just read something in a book. Oh, the Eastern philosophy says that you are one with God. Ah, I knew it. I knew it all the time. You know, it doesn't take much. It goes beyond all reason, but just within a second we'll accept that. So it's very common in the world. Now, here, then the question is, if we are God, if we are one with God, how is it that there is suffering? And, or, you know, we may accept the proper conclusion that we're not actually one with God in all respects, but we may be one with God in quality. We have the same spiritual quality. So still you can ask this question. If we're one with God in quality and the Supreme Lord sits within our heart, then we still want to ask the question, you know, how is it that we're suffering, you know, misfortune, and, you know, there's all sorts of illusion and things that you wouldn't associate with someone who's spiritual by nature and therefore blissful and full of knowledge. So it's a very, very good question. And of course, those who doubt the existence of spirit altogether, they may also ask this question. Oh, if there's God or if we're spiritual, then how are we suffering? So they may ask it in that way. So, in fact, the same question may be asked from people who have all different perspectives, from personalism to atheism. They may still ask this question, so it's a really good question. So the answer, of course, is very wonderful, that in essence it's being described here that the qualities which belong to the subtle body and the gross material body, they do not actually belong to the self, although they appear to. That's the answer. How is it the living entity is, you know, experiencing illusion and suffering and so many things? Is because those qualities are not there within the actual self, the soul, but they're there within the subtle body and the gross body. So, in one sense, you know, when we go back to the spiritual world, eventually, it's something like waking up from a bad dream. And, you know, once they ask Srila Prabhupada, when you go back to the spiritual world, do you remember your material existence? Prabhupada said, yes. You know, it's something like, you know, you've had some bad dream. You know, you can remember it at that. It's some memory, but you realize that actually, you know, what happened didn't actually happen to you. We go through millions and millions of lifetimes in the material world, in different bodies and all sorts of different emotions of distress and so-called happiness. But actually, really nothing is happening. You know, it's described in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that even though the soul is eating and sleeping and moving and, you know, talking and so many things, actually they're doing nothing. They're not going anywhere, they're not doing anything. It's like a person laying in bed. You know, they're sleeping and they appear to be doing so many things, but really they're just laying there doing nothing at all. You know. So of course this verse also is you know, part of a series of questions which by Badura, which is connected to the, you know, how does a living entity fall from the spiritual world? In one sense, you can say he doesn't really fall. He never really becomes, you know, he's the spirit soul's real position is never really lost. We don't lose our spiritual identity. We don't lose our spiritual relationship with Krishna. None of that, you know, it's in a dormant state. It's just, you know. So sometimes, you know, you can fall asleep for just a few seconds, and within those few seconds you can have a dream which seems to last for hours. Ever done that? You said that you fall asleep, just a few seconds, you might feel like you're, you experience this if you're really tired. You go to sleep, and when you're really tired, you feel like, I'm walking, it's really hard to drag my feet, and you just feel like you're going for hours, and you wake up, and you've only been asleep for 2 seconds, but you feel like you've just been struggling for hours and hours like that. So material world is like that. It's just, just a brief moment in our eternal life. Millions and millions of lifetimes, go by in the material world, and really, really nothing is happening. So, these verses are connected like that. What is happening is happening to the subtle body and the gross body, which is really just a reflection of the self upon the material energy. Within this purport, Srila Prabhupada, quoting the various acharyas and giving his own realizations, they bring forth so many different aspects of this very wonderful analogy, which helps us to understand something which is very, very difficult philosophically to understand. So it's a philosophical truth, and sometimes something is very difficult to understand, but if we can see it happening in front of our eyes, then we can accept it. So literally, this is something where, we might, if you try to imagine us as a spirit soul somehow, being covered by the material energy and going through millions of lifetimes, and that's not really happening to the soul in one sense, it's very hard. But to see an example of the same thing, then we can perceive it. So when we see the moon reflected in the water, actually you can draw a lot of similarities between what happens to the soul. So first of all, in this example, the Supreme Soul, the Personality of Godhead, is compared to the moon in the sky. So when we see the reflection of the moon in the water, the moon is representing the Personality of Godhead, and the living entities are compared to the reflection of the moon on the water. So the if the moon is in the sky, the moonlight causes the reflection. It's not that the moon comes down into the water, but the light of the moon comes down connected with the water. So it is that reflection, those particles of moonlight, which appear on the reflection of the water. So, in essence, it is the particles of moonlight which then give the appearance of shivering in the water. The moon in the sky is fixed and does not appear to quiver like the moon on the water. Actually, like the original moon in the sky, the moon reflected on the water should not quiver. But because of being associated with water, the reflection appears to be quivering, although in fact the moon is fixed. The water moves, but the moon does not move. Similarly, the living entities appear to be tainted by material qualities like illusion, lamentation, and miseries, although in the pure soul, such qualities are completely absent. So they're apparently there, but actually they're not there, those qualities. And in brackets, it's like the experience of having one's head cut off in a dream. which was discussed in the previous verse. The reflection of the moon on the water is the separated rays of the moon and not the actual moon. So the moon is not actually quivering. It's just the separated rays of moonlight appear to be quivering in the water. The separated parts and parcels of the Lord entangled in the water of material existence have the quivering quality, whereas the Lord is like the actual moon in the sky, which is not at all in touch with water. So the living entities are in touch with the material energy, but the Lord doesn't actually touch the material energy. In the same way, the moonlight reflects in the water, but the moon remains in the sky. Nice analogy there. So then we get these qualities. So I'll give you an example, a strange example, a personal example. But on Saturday, I was just about to come to the temple, and there's a doctor in the house, and I was on my way because I had a couple of orders for ceremonies, and I had to see some people about weddings. But I had a headache, and a doctor had prescribed to me, if you get a headache, take a Disprin, because it's also good for the blood pressure and things like that. Because I haven't had a Disprin in maybe about 40 years or something, so I didn't realise, but I'd actually developed a reaction to the Disprin. So Srimurti gave me a Disprin, and I said to her, I don't feel very well. My lips are trembling and feel very tight because they were swelling. I'm finding it hard to breathe, and my eyes feel like they've got sand in it because my eyes were actually puffing up, I couldn't breathe. So I sat down on the bed, and I was struggling to breathe. So I had a ventilator thing at home. Is that what they call them? So you breathe in helps get your lungs going, and was puffing on the asthma puffers and so many different things. Anyway, Srimurti saying, I'll call an ambulance. And I'm saying, no, because I'm thinking I've got to go to the temple to do my services like this. So she's saying, no, I'll call an ambulance. I said, don't call an ambulance, because I'll be right soon, I'll be okay, and I'll just settle down. So what she did was she brought a mirror in and she showed me my face. My face had puffed up, like my eyes were out here. There was a couple of slits. I looked Chinese. There was a couple of slits. Apparently I couldn't see. My hair was like swelling and drooping down. My lips were like, big lips, and they were sort of so, they all drooped. My face was sort of drooping because it was so swollen. I couldn't recognize myself. And then I sort of realized how much trouble I was in and how much trouble I was breathing. So I said, when's that ambulance coming? But, it was interesting because, I was still seeing myself in one way. I wasn't quite, I was just seeing myself as just, Ganga off to the temple. Like that, even though I was really ill. But my wife was, seeing me in a completely different way. And then Biruni got up, of course, and she came in and just looked at me and just burst out crying because I just looked so bad. The ambulance came, and they took me to the hospital. The entire day in the hospital, and they pumped me up with adrenaline and all sorts of things. I'm still recovering, so I didn't play the Mridanga. But I was just reflecting on the fact that we have I didn't quite, it took me quite a while to actually identify with the body. Like I was just still identifying myself in a certain way. That, you know, I'm just a devotee on my way to the temple. You know, that was my, you know, identity. And I didn't quite identify myself. It took me a while until when I saw myself in the mirror, then I realized, oh, you know, that I began to identify more with the body. Whoa, you know. And so it's like that. And I know also, just, you know, there's another little example, just when I used to dream in the beginning of being a devotee, I would sometimes dream of myself before I was a devotee. But, you know, for about 30 years or something, whenever I dream of myself, I only ever dream of myself wearing, you know, dhoti, tilak, and usually. And if I'm anywhere, even in a dream, if I'm somewhere and there's no kirtan, I usually think, why isn't anyone chanting, you know, like this? And you know, I'll sometimes, I'll say, let's do some chanting. And I'll start chanting, like, you know, Hare Krishna. And then, you know, someone behind me, you know, it could be in a shop or something like that. And then, you know, there's a big chorus of kirtan. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's good, like that. But, you know, it's that the tendency, you know, it's, you know, what I'm trying to say here is that as a devotee, the process is very powerful in helping, you know, the devotees to not identify themselves as the material body. That's, you know, the process is like that. You know, so it's no, you know, don't take it as a reflection of I have any advancement. You know, it's just the nature of the process. If you actually engage in devotional activities constantly, fully, it has that effect that it changes your identity back from being a material body to, you know, just perceiving yourself as a spirit soul. And, you know, I've experienced that even though I haven't really made much advancement. But I know that, you know, there are quite considerable things. And, you know, that what happened to me on Saturday, you know, I was sort of reflecting on that. It really took me quite a while. Well, I was practically, you know, I actually almost died. And I was still just seeing myself as, you know, Ganga on the way to the temple, you know. And which is, I took as a good thing. But my wife, anyway, I thank my wife for the wonderful Valentine's gift. And we spent a lovely day at the hospital together. She read me the. I didn't make it to the Bhakti Bhai Bhava class, but I had a private Bhakti Bhai Bhava class with Srimurti. She read the chapter in the hospital, so somehow or another I still got to do that. But yeah, so the more we identify with the material body, of course, the more we identify with the suffering. So, you know, Prabhupada describes it, actually a devotee, you know, the Bhagavatam also describes it, a devotee doesn't suffer like ordinary persons in this world. It doesn't mean that they don't get sick. You know, some people take it like that. They'll read in the Bhagavatam, it says, you know, a devotee doesn't suffer like, and then they say, oh, you know, you've had some tooth problem, you know, you've had this and you've had that, you know. You know, you're still dying and what have you, you know. So how can you say you're not suffering? Like, and that is because devotees actually don't identify with the body, you know, even from the beginning stages. Pretty much as soon as you hear that you're not their body, it actually has a big effect on you. Prabhupada tells a story that, you know, when he, you know, some of his friends were doctors. There was one doctor was going to perform a medical operation on a little baby. The baby had a boil, and it had to be lanced. And the doctor just pulled out his scalpel and he was going to lance the boil, and Prabhupada said, are you going to apply some local anaesthetic? Because in those days they didn't do the needle so much, but you know, so they put some local anaesthetic, something. But no, no, no. Prabhupada was, you know, a little astounded, but you know, as a little baby, you're not going to put any. And the doctor said, actually, because his consciousness is not focused on that, on what I'm doing, he won't feel it. And then, you know, the doctor cut the thing, and the baby didn't even notice, because his consciousness is not there. And you know, it's something we tell the children as well. You know, if they go to get a needle, you know, you probably know. If you try to distract them when they're about to get the needle or when they get their ears pierced. Right? If you distract them, I do this when I do hair cutting as well. You try and distract them as much as you can, and you know, they feel something, but not as much as if their consciousness is fully focused. You know, they're looking at the big needle coming from the doctor, you know, like that, and they tense up like this, and you know, the needle's hard to get in because they've tensed up like that. But you know, you say, oh, look, there's a lollipop, and they're over there, and the doctor's gone bang. No, they didn't even notice. You know? They didn't even notice. So, for a devotee, it's like that. That you know, these things happen. We've still got the material body to deal with, but a devotee doesn't identify more and more. And of course, in you know. Great devotees like Srila Prabhupada, we see, you know, that, you know, even practically, you know, moments from leaving his body, you know, as the doctors pointed out, he should be, because of the circumstances of, you know, how he's lying there, he should be in considerable distress. But Prabhupada is just translating, you know, the Bhagavatam right to the last moments of his life, just completely, you know, aloof from the fact that he's, you know, in this terrible condition of the body, and he's about to leave the body, and he's just totally focused as he ever was on the Bhagavatam. That's where his focus has been. And of course, for us as devotees, this is what we try to practice. You know, if we identify ourselves as Krishna's devotees and not as the body, and if we practice that, always, you know, identifying ourselves with our service, you know, to Krishna, then that attraction to our service, attraction to the devotees, attraction to Krishna, it becomes so fixed up that, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 6th chapter, that even in the greatest difficulties, a devotee, you know, we should come to the platform where, you know, there's very little disturbance, you know, to our consciousness at that. So it's not that these things, and that verse there, as it describes there, that even in the greatest difficulty, you know, once situated in that samadhi, you know, they're not disturbed, they're not shaken. That verse is also indicating to a devotee, don't think that you won't end up in the greatest difficulty. And just because you become an advanced yogi or devotee, don't think that there won't be some great difficulty. That verse is saying that. Even in the greatest difficulty, you'll not be shaken. That means difficulty is coming, you know, even though you're a yogi, you're a devotee like that. So, the more we... So we have that great blessing of Krishna consciousness to always associate ourselves with our spiritual nature. And... Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, whenever, sometimes when he would see actually Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji, when he would see Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur coming, he would say, "Oh, here comes that nice little gopi," like that, you know. So, you know, when we see a picture of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we see this great scholar, you know, very strict sannyasi, like that, you know, with the glasses, very intellectual, like that. And Srila Gaurakishore says, "Oh, here comes that nice little gopi," like that. You know. So he's perceiving, you know, his original spiritual quality like that. And of course, ultimately, as devotees, you know, become more and more detached from the bodily conception of life and more absorbed in devotional service, you know, after many, many years, devotees can read the pastimes of the Supreme Lord and they begin to identify themselves with those characters. It's like sometimes you watch a movie and, you know, you identify with one particular character and, you know, when they cry, you cry, "Oh, God." You know, it's like when they, you know, excited, you become all excited like that. You identify one particular character like that. So when you're actually reading the pastimes of Krishna, gradually, through purification, your own spiritual nature tends to become more and more prominent. And there's a certain taste and a certain flavour that you identify with certain. And of course this is all happens under the direction of an elevated spiritual teacher. But we learn from the acharyas such as Narottam Das Thakur, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada that, you know, as we're reading sometimes, you know, the acharyas, they may be reading how, you know, the various gopis may be dressing Srimati Radharani. And they may be thinking, "Oh, you know, if I was there, you know, I'd love to brush her hair like this and, you know, put some nice braids." But, you know, that service actually, that meditation gradually comes from fleeting thoughts to a constant samadhi of serving internally. And ultimately, those devotees enter into those pastimes, actually, like that. You know. So then, even though they're performing devotional activities externally, they're also, there's always an internal meditation, and they're literally, you know, entering in. Therefore, there's some very nice pastimes with Shyamananda Prabhu, who you know, used to, he was told by Jiva Goswami, "You go and clean the kund here." This is the kund of one of the gopis, and he would go and clean that kund, and he would meditate on how he would serve, you know, the various Brajabasis if they were there like that. And then of course one day there was a pastime which he perceived, and Radharani dropped her bangle, and there was a whole pastime associated with that. So gradually that meditation, one enters into the pastimes like that. So, but it begins from, you know, just not associating with the body, associating ourselves as a devotee, and then gradually as Krishna consciousness progresses over the course of a lifetime or some lifetimes, our particular individual eternal nature as a devotee becomes manifest, and gradually that allows us to re-enter the pastimes. And then one day we, you know, appear back in the spiritual world and we think, you know, what a bad dream, that whole material existence, some bad dream like that. And then we're back with Krishna. So I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions.
Garments on it like this. So he's designed that way to serve. So how do we understand?
Yeah, it's even though, for instance, yeah, the question is that, it's a good question, probably beyond my ability, but I'll try and answer it from what I understand, that, you know, we should not, it's sort of impertinent to, you know, desire to directly serve rather than Krishna. You know, it's we should always desire to serve through, you know, the Vaishnavas and the spiritual master like that. And then sometimes we do read, as he was describing, that the acharyas may be, you know, offering prayers, I'd like to, you know, render service to Srimati Radharani like that. It appears that they're saying it directly. It's not factual. They're usually, if you look into those pastimes where they're praying to, you know, serve Srimati Radharani, perhaps in dressing or, you know, or Krishna, you know, in some particular way, they're doing it in the association of other devotees. And if you look at that pastime, there's always a leader, you know. So it appears that they're asking for direct service, but they're sort of in a whole group of associates, and there's always a leader in that group. So, you know, as you read through the various, you know, pastimes of the Lord, and, you know, there are some Astakalya Leela and things like that, not that we should jump into those things, but you see that those pastimes unfold, and, you know, particular gopis or cowherd boys or what have you, who are leaders amongst the group, are engaging all the others in a certain way, in a certain mood, and those acharyas are desiring to serve within that group under that leader. So it's not actually direct. So you just got to go even a little further in the same song, and you'll find that it is confirmed. Yeah. So.